Ladies and gentlemen, welcome along to this session on localisation and globalisation. Sunday morning, how are we all feeling?
Great.
3 days of thinking, listening, conversing. I know I've been to the Port Ferry Folk Festival occasionally, and by the time you get to the last morning, it's sort of just is all washing over you, and you're in this beautiful space and place. And is everyone there?
Yeah.
No? Is everyone ready for a really intense discussion? That doesn't usually happen on a Sunday morning. Ready for it?
Energized.
You want to be energized?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, sounds good. Well, we have Jose here to energise us for starters and to set the scene for our discussion. Then we have Raphael Suchere and Jacques Boulay, who are going to join us up on stage to hopefully get the energising happening even further in conversation. So Jose is originally from California, Mexican-American and Indigenous ancestry. He has a great passion for community initiatives going way back to student days. He's got a doctorate from QUT in Global Studies, Foresight and Sustainability, and he has 12 years of experience researching foresight and sustainability strategies and working with a variety of people, community groups and organisations in developing sustainability and foresight initiatives. He's published over a dozen peer-reviewed articles in these areas. He's done extensive work in community development, helping found the Melbourne Social Forum and Plug In TV, and has been also involved in the Oasis Sustainability School. We were lucky enough to have him up in Bendigo a couple of years ago, to work, and he worked with 50 people in Bendigo on what it is to think strategically about the future. And we had some fantastic things flowing from that program. So he's going to excite us now about Cosmo Location, peer-to-peer solidarity systems. And Cosmo Location, localisation draws on strategic links between global P2P production of knowledge and commons and relocalisation of material production through the maker movement. Can you give him a huge round of applause and welcome to Castlemaine?
Thank you very much, and thank you so much, Ian. It's great to be here and be co-opted into yet another beautiful gathering, beautiful initiative. So what is Cosmo Localization? It's a conjunction between two terms. The cosmopolitan, I need to get closer. Further, I'm too loud.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Relax, Jose, right? So, cosmo-localization is a conjunction of two terms. The cosmopolitan, which is the global, and localization, the local. It describes the new global-local dynamics in the generation of value, new technologies, and the imperative to create resilient communities is driving initiatives for relocalization. But this relocalization is being enabled by an emerging architecture and resources in the global knowledge commons. So to give an example, emerging designs for electric cars from Tesla, but earlier from the Rocky Mountain Institute, are now open and they're commons-based. If we have the capacity, we can actually grab those open-source designs and produce it ourselves. So there's other initiatives like MakerBot. They make 3D printers. The Global Village Construction Set, which I'll talk about in a minute. And a lot of medicines have been made as part of the Global Knowledge Commons. People are increasingly making their medicines Creative Commons, so that they bypass the way in which pharmaceuticals patent medicines for very long time periods. In fact, we might say that any globally distributed open source project which allows local instantiations is an example of cosmo-localization. And there are many other examples where this is happening, from food to many different things. From the behemoth production processes typical of industry today, in which a massive factory produced millions of units from a factory system, which then gets exported and traded overseas, we actually now have the means to do local production and bypass that kind of trade system using the designs and the knowledge and support available in our distributed and global knowledge commons, and by finding local alternative materials and resources. And the question really is whether local communities can leverage the potential of this global knowledge commons towards smart relocalization. And the question is, can we do this? Can we do this with, let's say, the technology for our phones, or computers, or cars, or food production and processing systems, and all the various other things that are needed or wanted by people and by communities? So that really is the kind of general space, and that's what cosmo-localization means. Now what I want to do is talk about the trends that are pointing towards and potentiating and enabling a cosmo-localized future. So the first one really is the emerging knowledge commons. The knowledge commons is the pool of knowledge resources that is widely available on the internet for use and for reuse. We all know about Wikipedia, produced by millions of contributors and used by many more millions of people. So in terms of cosmo-localization, what we're really looking for are knowledge resources which potentiate local production capacities. So in this regard, there's some very specific examples, such as a project called the Civilizational Construction Set. Now, this project was started by urbanites who decided to become farmers, and they, when they went out to do this, they had a lot of trouble being able to afford the equipment and being able to construct the equipment. And what they decided to do was to create a list of all of the farming equipment that they would need to run a farm and to source it globally from a community of designers, a little bit like Wikipedia, but for running a farm. And then once they did that, they went to the next state and said, actually, we want all of the machines that would be required to be foundations for civilization. We want them to be open source designs that anybody can use and create on their own farms or communities. Another example is the MakerBot company. The MakerBot company creates 3D printers. And when you get a 3D printer with MakerBot, you can go to what they call the Thingiverse. And in the Thingiverse, there are hundreds of thousands of designs that people can download. So you can download a design for a cup, or a design for a vase, or a design for many different things, and then print it from your home. Right, so you have a knowledge resource, which is distributed and global, but you have the local capacity for the 3D printing. Now, there are literally hundreds upon hundreds of global knowledge pools which potentiate local production, from the design of agricultural systems that I just mentioned, to medical applications and medicines, to even the building of electric cars. Tesla recently made the designs for their cars open source. And I think, as Elon Musk put it, our problem is not the competition, but that we don't have enough competition. He wants other people to be building electric cars, so the infrastructure gets developed. The other trend that's driving this potential is obviously technology and the reducing costs, or the gradually reducing costs of certain manufacturing equipment. So, for example, 3D printing has gone from an expensive hobby that may have cost someone $3,000 or $4,000 5 years ago to now something which will cost someone $500 or $700, and soon maybe $250. The underlying technology which potentiates these different technology systems are microcontroller systems. Now, these microcontroller systems are also increasingly open source and available in our distributed knowledge commons. So we can draw from that pool. In the Maker Lab that I helped to found in Footscray, one of the founding members built his own 3D printers using the Arduino microcontroller platform, and he literally produces his own 3D parts and programs the microcontroller system based on existing software that he can download. Now, microcontrollers are also becoming more cheap and accessible and drive a number of applications. So, like 3D printing, to robotics, the Internet of many applications in the Internet of Things, CNC routers, and different types of equipment. Now, some people would say, well, you can only 3D print small cups and vases. How would you be able to do that at a larger scale? Well, there's larger scale applications, and in China, an inventor has actually created technology to 3D print houses, and he's shown houses being 3D printed in under a day. So the technology is just beginning. There's enterprise 3D printing, and that's already becoming well established. We've already seen space modules by NASA 3D printed, as well as engine aircraft parts. Now, enterprise 3D printing needs to be distinguished from hobby 3D printing, but when I talk about cosmo-localization, I really mean enterprise-scale 3D printing that can support local economies. So there's a difference between the hobby 3D printing and the larger one there. Okay, the third thing that is potentiating cosmo-localization is the maker movement. The maker movement is a very broad church and includes everything from people involved in pre-industrial handcrafts such as jewelry making, textiles, well-established industrial crafts such as metal foundry work, power-based woodwork and welding. But it also straddles the high-tech end of the spectrum of all the technologies that I just mentioned. So the so-called maker movement is very broad, from people making things in their home with handcrafts to what we commonly do with saws and with welding equipment to the high-tech stuff. In addition to this, I would argue that the maker movement has a strong commitment to open source and knowledge justice approaches, localization, community learning, sustainable closed-loop manufacturing. In my own Maker Lab community, I've been criticized for leaving offcuts from manufacturing processes. I was part of a design process that created wicking beds, and the wicking beds created little offcuts. So at the end, we had a big pile of offcuts. And I had several people from the community say, why are there offcuts to your manufacturing process? Obviously, you got the design wrong. And so I kind of just took it on the chin and moved on. But there is a strong commitment to upscaling and reuse in that community. It's a very broad church with a lot of specialized knowledge and craftspeople who are totally obsessed with what they do. And to me, the real potential lies in the broad church beginning to learn from each other's knowledges and capabilities and to collaborate on the design and manufacturing of things that require a high level of coordination and organization. The maker movement is a network and is dynamic, but is not very well coordinated. And to make things for commerce requires disciplined coordination and organization, which is more typical of industrial models, even at a local level. So we really have to learn organization within this network of making if we want to scale it and we want to really potentiate localized production capabilities. We really do need to learn organization. Okay, the fourth major trend that is potentiating cosmo-localization is urbanization and megacity regions. This is driving cosmo-localization. Well, it potentiates it. In many parts of the world, and not just the developing world, we know that rapid urbanization is happening in, say, Jakarta or in other Asia-Pacific large cities. But I believe that the rise of megacity regions are critical because cities are locales of diverse production capabilities, as well as diverse needs and markets. Megacity regions have scales which allow for localized production capabilities to cater to larger populations. So I just want to do a little thought experiment here. Imagine that no more cars could be imported into Victoria or Melbourne at all. So the region would need to produce its own vehicles, let's say. Suddenly, we would have to figure out how to do this quickly. Luckily, we have several factors in our favor. The design for electric cars like Tesla and prototypes from the Rocky Mountain Institute are widely available. We also have tens of thousands of people that have specialization in many different industries that can solve complex problems. And finally, there's a market of 5 million or so people who already are paying for vehicles and in the future could do so, whether it's through the old driver-owned, driver-occupied system that Frank Fisher used to talk about as the Dodo system, or a new commons or peer-to-peer-based rideshare system. We could find the financial means to capitalize such a project. We could take this thought experiment and apply it to hundreds of different industries, and I would guess that cities would be able to solve many of their own problems and produce many of the things that cities need. I don't think that we would be able to solve all our problems. There are some things we need to get from other parts of the world. But what I'm pointing towards, what I'm trying to say, is that we have the potential for a city-based cosmo-localization. And Melbourne's got 5 people, small compared to Los Angeles with 12. Los Angeles is small compared to Mexico City with 24 million. And Mexico City is small compared to Tokyo with 32 million. So I think there are different scales at which this can work. And I also think that if you begin to look at the trends on urbanization and megacity regions, within the next 20 to 30 years, we'll have dozens of cities that are the size of Mexico City or Tokyo, and perhaps hundreds the size of Los Angeles and Melbourne. Okay, so that was number 4, trend number 4. The fifth trend that begins to potentiate cosmo-localization is distributed energy production and storage. So there are new technologies now that are allowing us to not only generate the energy, but store it off-site. So even if we don't have cities driving a process like cosmo-localization, new advances in distributed energy production and storage mean that we can increasingly advance cosmo-localization aims wherever that technological capacity exists. Tesla has just developed their Tesla Powerwall, which allows people to essentially, instead of having to export your energy off-grid or into the grid, let's say you have solar panels in your house, you can just put it right into the Powerwall. Previously, we've had to figure the whole thing out ourselves, have big marine batteries that can store lots of energy, and very few people actually have the expertise or the patience or even the confidence to do that. You're dealing with electricity. So these new systems will potentiate distributed energy storage, which then allows us to power production processes. Now the sixth trend that's driving cosmo-localization or has potential to support it is resource scarcity, precarity, and ecological integrity. As resources become more and more scarce, into the future we'll need to become more and more adept at upcycling and repurposing things in general. And I'm basically saying that we can deal with some aspects of resource scarcity through mapping and designing urban metabolic flows. So one of the projects that we've done at the Footscray Maker Lab is we've worked with 3 elements. One is waste outputs, locale for upcycling, and creating new markets with people who want to do this kind of thing. So we looked at what could we design that is widely available in the community. So in the western suburbs of Melbourne, lots of pallets get thrown out. So we said, okay, what are we going to build with the pallets? We're going to build wicking beds. And I talked a little bit about the wicking bed design. I created a few offcuts. Got criticized for that. The Maker Lab was the locale for the upcycling. We would take the offcuts, I mean the offcuts, the pallets. We would then use them in the Maker Lab to construct wicking beds. We partnered with the local Chin Burmese migrant community who are interested in enterprise development approaches. And so they decided to be the ones to build it, to build these wicking beds. And we worked on creating a local market of people who are interested in buying it. Right? So if we begin to map urban resources, waste, we can create new systems of metabolic flows within our communities. We can combine new production capacities to do more of this kind of thing. Now, some of these things I don't think are simply going to be ecologically benign. When I inhaled the fumes from a 3D printer, I got a headache, to give you an example. So I don't think we should automatically think that because it's part of the maker movement, all of these technologies equal ecological integrity. They don't, okay? They potentiate localized production. We do have to think about ecological resilience and closed-loop processes in conjunction with that, not as technologies of panacea for, but in conjunction. But there are efforts to make upcycling hoppers that transform household plastics into filament material for 3D printers. So people are actually working on the conjunctions between these things. Overall, I think localized industrial urban metabolisms will be key in generating environmental integrity outcomes. And finally, as part of this trend, is basically precarity. Precarity has hit young populations across the world, in the US after the GFC, in Europe after the Eurozone crisis. And it's been in Africa and Latin America and many other parts of the world. We're basically isolated from a lot of that precarity. We do experience it, but not like other countries do. So cosmo-localization potentially creates enterprise opportunities for those people who may not have work to create livelihoods, to begin to produce things for their communities in new ways. Okay, so those are the trends that are driving cosmo-localization, but there are actually some fundamental obstacles to being able to enact this kind of scenario. So I want to talk about three basic obstacles to doing this. The first one is the idea of platform oligopoly. And I know that's a bit of jargon, but I'll get into what exactly that means. So one of the most basic obstacles is right under our noses. It's the power of big Silicon Valley enterprises to monopolize and potentially suppress the potential for cosmo-localization. So all of these big platforms like Facebook, Google, and sharing platforms like Airbnb and Uber, they have one thing in common. They derive value from our practices of relationality. They essentially thrive somewhat parasitically on our own interactions with each other. We can reframe this in a post-Marxist sense. If Marx said, and I don't know if he said this or not, but someone said it. We can check with Jacques. they who own the means of production, right? But today, it's not just they who own the means of production. It's actually they who own the means of relationality, because those are the platforms that mediate relationality. Now, there's no doubt I see value in some of the things that they've innovated, and I use their platforms and I use their products. And I don't know how I would survive without Google Docs. The problem is that the value generated from these platforms is not shared for social reinvestment locally, but ends up paying for a venture capitalist golf club membership in Palo Alto. Okay, so that's the fundamental problem with that model. It's actually the nature of the Silicon Valley venture capitalist system in general. So the sharing economy has quickly moved from incubation and innovation to early adoption, and now we're right at the cusp of the explosion of the sharing economy. And this is where I fear that some of these companies will simply buy the most successful model of sharing platform or maker platform, and they'll turn it into a franchise. And it'll be mic sharing and mic making, essentially. And there'll be franchises everywhere, and it might be called Google Make or Facebook Share or whatever. And they have all the capabilities. They even have currency systems that they can switch on right now if they want to do that. So this is what Michelle Bowens calls netarchical capitalism. It's the capitalism of the platform, and it's the capitalism that derives value from our means of relationality. I think it's a critical issue. I think it's a really critical issue. Another major obstacle is political in nature. So this is a different obstacle. What we consume is based on the legacy of industrial production. You know, whenever we go into Kohl's or whenever we buy a computer, whatever, we're all embedded in the legacy of industrial production. And there are many, many incumbents who don't want to lose business. And they will lobby governments vigorously to make life more difficult for cosmo-localized production and startup enterprises. This is one of the reasons behind the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that pharmaceutical companies want to maintain their monopolies on medicines. They don't want these medicines to be part of the global knowledge commons so that anyone can, or any nation says, we've got an AIDS problem, we've got a problem with this disease or that, we're going to produce it ourselves and we're going to do it at a tenth of the price. So both in the US and Australia, state policymaking has been co-opted to a great extent by moneyed interests. In the United States, it's completely out of control. And in Australia, it is a problem as well. So I believe that for localization to work, it has to go beyond the local. If you want to empower the local, you can't abandon the state as a locale of power, as a locale where the adjudication of power actually happens. And that's why I think we need to have alliances of commons-based enterprises that work together to form cosmo-localized networks, alternatives, to create favorable policy conditions. We actually have to scale from the local to the national to create favorable policy conditions in this regard. And this is, again, where I draw from Michelle Bowens, where he argues that in the long term, we need to create what he calls a partner state. The partner state is the state that supports localized commons-based resilience and production. And we need to fight through the national mechanisms to create that fight and dialogue to create that partnership model. And if anyone's interested in this kind of partnership model, Michelle Bowens did a project in Ecuador, a major project called the FLOC project, Free Libre Open Knowledge Society, in which the whole idea was to form the basis for national policymaking around drawing on the global knowledge commons for localized production. So there's actually a case study out there that does this. Now the third obstacle for this, for cosmo-localization, is intellectual property regimes. So the global policy that's pushed through the WTO or TRIPS and now the Trans-Pacific Partnership all have the common aim of enfolding nations into the legacy of Western European intellectual property law. Basically, it's positivist law in technical terms. And positivist law, in the most basic terms, is simply contractual law. It does not acknowledge any contextual, cultural, or historical dimensions in the use or possession or governance of a thing. It simply says, you signed a contract, hand it over. So this is why certain companies can buy a life support system from a government, such as when Bechtel bought the water supply for Cochabamba in Bolivia and then hiked up the prices for local residents, because it's perfectly legal, even though it's a contradiction to the living conditions and the needs of people. So today there are people dying from diseases around the world because they can't get access to cheaper versions of the medicines that would cure the diseases. And this is because certain intellectual property regimes do not allow people to produce their own local versions. I saw Peter Singer argue once, and I also see his point, that we actually need to have some system which incentivizes the innovation of medicines. So he argued vigorously for the importance of the patent regime system. I think we need to be able to express genius by holding the contradiction and the tension in our mind, that we actually need to have an investment system for innovation, however that is, and I don't think it has to be through hardcore patent regimes, but that's the one that we have now, and also the global knowledge commons based. And we need to be able to kind of conceive of how they work together. But in this case, I think we need to fight against the global neoliberal push to envelop the world in an antiquated intellectual property regime that is basically based on the logic of investment and return. And we need intellectual property systems that are commons-based, that may not even entail the notion of property, and that support smart resource localization. And we need to norm the knowledge commons through our own work. Okay, so I'm going to end with a scenario for cosmo-localization. Let's say it's 2050. A large proportion of the global economy is now enabled by a global knowledge commons and a design commons, which in turn supports highly distributed localized production and manufacturing. A lot of the world trade has now switched to the trade in intellectual resources. And people are producing through local resources, drawing on solidarities of knowledge from around the world. Cosmo-localization flourishes where the information architecture is protected, where government policy supports access and the use of the knowledge commons. It displaces some form of manufactured goods, many forms of manufactured goods, especially where energy descent and transition dynamics have increased the cost of transportation. It has led to a new geography of economic clustering. Basically, the idea of micro-clustering. Instead of having these large-scale industrial clusters that have been, you know, that national governments have devoted themselves to, it's the idea of micro-clustering. So, micro-clustering around faster, lighter, cheaper innovation and ways of making things. The importance of actual co-location despite the potential of online collaboration, making cities the sites of micro-industry clustering. Micro-clustering emerging around economic geography, which may be hard to predict, but may be a combination of different capital, culture, geographic, and knowledge elements. So cosmo-localization would still be constrained by the depth and breadth of the global knowledge commons and restrictions around national and local policy setting. High-value manufacturing would still require specialist equipment, much of which is still under existing IP regimes, and which would be capital-intensive. And even where open designs are available, precision and scale are still significant issues in high-value manufacturing and production that require economies of scale. Local and cyber currencies may play a major role in cosmo-localization, which facilitates the exchange of economic value and investments across space and time in ways that are not constrained by traditional currency capital flows. So one of the big challenges in enterprise scale cosmolocalization, being able to really produce robustly at a local level in a way that we can live sufficiently, is capital investment. And so basically what I'm saying is local and cyber currencies can both play a role in addressing that problem of capital investment for cosmolocalization. In addition to this, cyber currencies can play a major role in allowing for the exchange between micro-clustering regions. There may be micro-clustering regions all around the world, such that trade facilitates and enhances localized production rather than destroying it. At the moment, trade at its in its industrial legacy systems destroys local production. How do we create a system of trade in intellectual resources and in the specialist things that we need that actually supports localized economic production? I can imagine a time when a local Melbourne credit system or a local Victorian credit system will be traded in and through and across different credit systems from different cities and regions around the world, between Lagos, Jakarta, Los Angeles, Paris, and many different regions that have cosmo-localized micro-cluster economies. Okay, so in conclusion, I really want to see creativity at a local scale flourish, rather than our localities becoming wastelands where imported goods dominate and there's no currency for local goods. I'm not completely against local goods, but we've gone too far. I believe that local regions should have the right to legislate what is acceptable economic development and what is not. This is the principle of subsidiarity, devolving governance to the most basic and smallest unit, thereby empowering the most people. If a region does not want a McDonald's or a Walmart or a Google Make franchise, they should have the right to stop it. But this is a question of constitutional law. I want local cultures to flourish rather than get subsumed by global homogenous consumerism. And while I'm from the United States, and as a Mexican American, I know what it means to resist incorporation, as my parents and others performed through the Chicano movement to preserve and respect the dignity of who we are and the practices of who we are. And indeed, I often cringe when I see Americanisms uncritically adopted anywhere, and I get a very warm, fuzzy feeling when I see people really performing who they are and who they want to be. So, I am an ally of relocalization, and I have many books by Daly, Hines, Mander, Kavanaugh, Shiva, Norberg, Hodges, and the list goes on. I've got the whole library. Jacques can attest to that. But localization as an ideology can be both naive and dangerous. Naive in its blindness or lack of engagement with the role of national and transnational structures. Dangerous because it potentially leads people to a dead end where romantic ideals lead people to a loss of strategic efficacy in the face of real threats and real opportunities. So there are three problems that we need to deal with uncritically adopted and ideological relocalization: the power of capital and capitalism, the scale of the machine, and the threat of co-optation, the state and understanding state power and political policy making, the global knowledge regime, the cosmo and the cosmo localization, the power of global knowledge regimes to limit the capacity for local creativity. So, therefore, cosmolocalization activity is needed at multiple scales. We need the local production. We need alliances with distributed global knowledge commons. But we also need to build national engagement in policy and alliance building for that policy. And we need global knowledge and transnational political power as well in order to shape the global intellectual property regimes and to transform it indeed into a world of a global knowledge commons. Thank you very much.